Welcome to our event, Cancel Culture Comes to Bank. Should banks be allowed to cancel individuals? And this is co-hosted by the Silicon Valley and the San Francisco Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. Thank you all for participating in our Zoom presentation today. I'd like to just quickly thank not only our excellent speakers, John, Todd, and Daniel, but the supportive staff at the Federal Society, Alita Cass, Kate Fugate, Lisa Ezel, and Alessandro Cruz. They've been quarterbacking these events for us, and we really appreciate all their hard work. We will be offering a CLE to California lawyers today. The event is being recorded, and we would ask that, and I'll announce this again later on, but we'd ask that you use the Q&A section to enter your name, your full name, and your California bar number. And the Q&A section will then be is recorded along with the presentation, and we can use that as the record for CLE purposes, lest we be audited. So one other request, if you could join our Northern California Federal Society page on Facebook. It'll help us keep you apprised of events and developments, some interesting articles, and who knows, maybe a meme or two. We look forward to resuming in-person events soon. San Francisco and Silicon Valley are working on some speakers for this summer, and those will be announced via email and Facebook posts as well. My role, I'm Chris Hagee. I'm the chairman of the Silicon Valley chapter. My role today is really just to introduce Daniel Wheeler, our moderator. Daniel is the chief executive officer of Sunstone Trust Company. Mr. Wheeler led the successful effort to obtain its de novo trust company charter, and he's building Sunstone as a wealth management firm for first and second generation immigrants to the United States. Dan is also a founder of the commercial bank serving companies, that have been debanked due to their political disfavor. So he's familiar with the topic here. Dan is a longtime banking and fintech regulatory lawyer. Prior to becoming a full-time entrepreneur, Dan was a law firm partner and advised banks, fintechs, crypto companies, money service businesses, and other financial institutions on their most important challenges and opportunities. And he's gonna help us continue a discussion of those topics today. Daniel, if you would like to take over, I will go to mute.
Well, thank you, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity to be a moderator on a topic that I have tremendous personal and business interest in. I'm even more excited to have two truly impressive panelists here with me, which I will introduce in a very summary fashion, since reading their list of accomplishments would take us the full balance of the hour. We have on the video in front of us first, John Allison. He's an executive in residence at the Wake Forest School of Business. He's a member of the Cato Institute's board of directors and is the chairman of the Executive Advisory Council of the Cato Institute's Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives. Impressive to me, I'm a fan of John's for a long time. He was the chairman and CEO of BB&T Corporation, which was the 10th largest financial services holding company in the United States. And during his tenure as CEO, he grew that bank from $4.5 billion to $152 billion, an impressive track record. And in fact, he is recognized by the Harvard Business Review as one of the 100 most successful CEOs in the world. Among his many, many accomplishments and awards, he's been inducted into the North Carolina Business Hall of Fame and received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Banker publication. So a truly impressive CEO and well qualified to speak on this topic. Our other speaker, Todd Zwicky, is an accomplished lawyer and a tremendous thought leader. He is currently the George Mason University Foundation Professor of Law at George Mason University, Antonin Scalia School of Law. Quite the job title. He's also a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and a former executive director of the George Mason University Law and Economics Center. Recently, within the past, in 2020 and 21, he served as the chair of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Task Force on Federal Consumer Financial Law. He teaches in the area of bankruptcy, contracts, commercial law, law and economics, public choice, and the law. Among Todd's impressive accomplishments is he is one of the most downloaded legal authors currently. So he is second only to the Kardashians, apparently, in his popular. We're going to turn it over first to Todd to give us some introductory remarks on our topic, which is cancel culture comes to banking. Should banks be allowed and perhaps required to cancel individuals and industries based on their political or religious beliefs? Todd, take it away.
Thanks, Daniel. First, thanks to Chris and the Federal Society for organizing this. And it's a thrill to be on a panel with John Allison and Daniel Wheeler. There's the old saying that those who can't do teach. And if I've ever felt that way, sitting between John Allison, who built BB&T to one of the great financial institutions in the world, and Daniel Wheeler, who's founding his own institutions, is very humbling, and I'm looking forward to hearing their comments. So I'm going to set this question up and sort of orient those who haven't been following this in detail to give you a sense of what the landscape is here and why I'm very concerned about it, and maybe raise some new questions and new ways of thinking about that for those of us who believe in markets and are dedicated to free markets and the private sector. To think about some of the questions that are raised by this, because I think they're going to be getting bigger even going forward. And the question here is pretty clear, which is we've already mentioned Operation Choke Point. That was an initiative that really flourished during the Obama administration. It's unclear who exactly had their fingerprints on it, whether it was primarily the FDIC or the DOJ or who exactly. But basically what this was an initiative. And the name is illustrative, Operation Choke Point. They chose that name because they wanted to choke off the oxygen that certain industries needed to breathe. And that's why they chose that name, the oxygen being bank accounts more than anything else. And in our American system, basically, you cannot survive effectively in any meaningful way without a bank account. Certainly if you're a business, certainly if you're an individual who's doing anything more than sort of living just sort of day to day. And so that's why they knew that taking away bank accounts from companies would choke off the oxygen they needed to breathe. And so what they did was they targeted, they didn't tell anybody really, but they targeted completely legal businesses, payday lenders, gun shops, fireworks stores, coin sellers. One DOJ memo, I believe it was, said, make sure that every time you talk about Operation Choke Point, you talk about online pornography so you can wrap all the other industries in that veneer. And basically what they did was they systematically went through and they shut off bank accounts to these particular industries. And finally, the payday lenders sued after some of the payday lenders basically were run out of business because of their inability to be able to get access to a bank account to cash their customers' checks. And they sued, and various other things have happened. Well, what we've seen over the past few years is this is extended from this sort of formal sort of process by which the government, and I get sort of formal in quotes, formal process to an informal process. I say formal in quotes because during the Obama administration, it wasn't like they passed a rule that said, we're going to shut off bank accounts to these perfectly legal businesses. What they did was they used the sort of shady operations that financial regulators use, which is they use supervision, regional supervision, kind of this nudge, nudge, wink, wink sort of way they do it, you know, which is we think that, you know, dealing with payday lenders are icky. And so so you get a reputation risk from doing this. And what we see there is that this is something that's more pronounced in banking, but maybe not unique to banking, but it's been around for a long time in banking, which is a lot of what banking regulation is not anything that lawyers recognize as law. It's these sort of strong arm backroom tactics used from these supervisory agencies, where they just sort of hint to you how things should be done or what you should do in order to get a clean bill of health. And, you know, and they can basically make your life miserable. And if you just yield a little bit, play ball, we'll let things up. And so what we seem to be seeing now is, or can expect to see, is this ramping up. We've already seen it with the Fed has decided that they're going to get in the business of climate change control, right? And they're just talking about disclosures now, SEC's talking about it. But is there any financial regulation that really just comes down to being disclosures? Why disclose it, right? And why climate change risk, right? I mean, it's just a completely arbitrary choice. What about government debt? Are we going to say that government debt and, you know, $6 trillion budgets doesn't present some sort of risk that that certain financial institutions should worry about? And if it's some sort of social thing, why climate change? Why not the fact that, you know, I couldn't find a credible source, so I'm going to cite the World Health Organization for some statistics. According to the World Health Organization, 1.6 million people die in the world every year from indoor cooking, from indoor fires, from burning coal, wood, crop waste, and dung, yak dung, right? They're burning dung in people's houses in order to heat their houses in the winter and have cooking stoves. 1.6 million people, of which half are children. And we're going to say the biggest question, that overwhelmingly the only thing we're going to be concerned about is climate change, and not, there's no regulatory questions raised by the fact that 1.6 million people are dying every year because they lack access to fossil fuels and reliable sources of energy. It's completely arbitrary. Then we have now, adding on to it, the informal pressures, obviously from the left-wing activist groups, which are demanding that banks divest from fossil fuels and divest from, gun companies and things like that. You know, and often the response that free market believers say is, well, how would you like it if this got turned around on Planned Parenthood or somebody like that? Let's be realistic, folks. That's not going to happen. Nobody believes that's going to happen. But, and most of all, the left doesn't believe that's going to happen. It's the same argument that has failed for 25 years with speech codes on campus, is the left knows that they're never going to be punished in the same way that the conservatives or libertarians are punished under speech codes. And everybody understands that when it comes to using the regulatory state in this fashion, it's always going to be applied in a discriminatory fashion. And now we add the third layer, not just government regulation, not just the informal pressure, but now more and more bank CEOs are sort of volunteering to kind of throw themselves out there on this. And, you know, I just cite this sort of farcical hearing that we saw a week or two ago in Congress, where a whole lineup of big bank CEOs basically admitted that they had not read a single word of Georgia's so-called voter suppression law. They hadn't read a single word of it. They couldn't cite a single problematic provision in it. And what they said is basically some mid-level diversity bureaucrat in their company told them this is a bad thing. And so they came out against it. And so we have this whole array of things that are lining up that are causing certain industries to be systematically targeted, potentially. Certain individuals, as you might know, former President Trump had his bank account canceled after the events of January 6th. There's reports of other individuals who are so-called, you know, who are involved with groups that are that people don't like, who've had their bank accounts canceled. And why is this a problem? The problem is what I said. You need a bank account to be able to live. You need a bank account to be able to breathe, to be able to do anything nowadays, especially nowadays in this post-pandemic world where more and more transactions are online and in the like. Without a bank account, it's really hard to survive in this world. And so basically what this has become then is a form of political coercion, an ideological coercion to try to force people basically to at the risk of being depersoned, right? Not only can you lose your job now, as we've seen that people have happened, not only can you lose your reputation, you can essentially lose your ability to have any meaningful life whatsoever if banks can just take away your bank account and strip you the means you need to live. So let me just say a few words about where we go from here, having pointed out the question. Now, what the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency did at the very end of the Trump administration under the leadership of Brian Brooks was they issued a rule called the Fair Access Rule, which basically said that you can only take into account traditional measures of risk, such as financial risk and that sort of thing. And you can't take into account these sort of extraneous considerations like ideological issues. Now, from a free market person, you can obviously see why a rule like that would give you heartburn, right? Which is to say that to allow to have the government basically telling you who you can or can't bank with raises serious concerns. And my good friend John Berlau at the Competitive Enterprise Institute has written about this very ably. But I want to raise a question to think about whether there's another way to think about that. And it starts with this idea of the importance of banks to people's world, number one. And number two, the incredibly intensely regulated way in which banking is got regulated in this country, which is there are incredible barriers to entry. There's this incredible ability of banking regulators to impose on these companies. And that basically that the choices are limited for most people. Realistically, it's very hard. What these payday lenders, for example, found was that once they were debanked, they were debanked. What the individuals are finding is once they're debanked, they've been debanked. There are churches who have been debanked because of their views. And it's really hard to find another bank in this environment, in this sort of heated environment of woke politics and the like. The traditional way we've thought about this as free market people is we basically have two buckets. We've got public, we've got private. And basically the way we've traditionally thought about this is private actors can do whatever they want, and public actors have rules on them. I wonder if it's starting to be time to start thinking about whether that's more of a continuum than it is a binary choice, which is once you get over to banking, when banking is so heavily regulated, when barriers to entry are so extreme in the like, is there some point at which it becomes so important to people? Is there some point at which the traditional private public binary way of thinking about this is no longer useful? In the world of the second best, where the regulatory state has its tentacles in everything, The world of the second best is not the world of the first best. I wish we lived in a world where we had a large, vibrant private sector where people could engage in freedom of contract. But that's not the world in a lot of cases, and certainly not the world with respect to banking. And so the question is whether in the world of the second best, are we better off with a rule that's something like the Fair Access Rule rather than what we have today, which is a rule that allows these semi-private entities to pick and choose who they want to bank with, knowing that the fact is that it's going to be applied in a discriminatory fashion, as we have seen over the last few years. And obviously, the implications for this are broader. A lot of Federalist Society people have been thinking about what should we do about internet regulation, for example, especially for the backbone of the internet, like Amazon Web Services. What should we do in a world in which everybody says, well, if you don't like Twitter, start a competitor? So Parler starts up, and what do? They kill Parler. Right? It's like, nice try, suckers. You believed us, right? And And so I think there's an interesting question here, which is, in the current world, in the world of the second best, is a rule like this better than not? And it's easy to see what the drawbacks might be. It's also easy to see what the advantages to that might be in terms of dealing with the world where we are now. Richard Epstein, for example, has argued a similar thing about the internet, which is maybe there's an intermediate position. It's not at one of the polar extremes. And so with that, I'm going to leave it on that with a question rather than an answer as to how we should think about this and think about the fair access rules. So thank you for your patience and allowing me to ramble.
Todd, thank you. That was a lot of passion, and I appreciate that. Here's a suggested way for John perhaps to respond and add his thoughts, and you can ignore this if you like, John, but from your experience as a CEO, you have regulatory pressures, you have shareholder pressures, you have your board pressures, you have a lot of pressures on you as a CEO. And sometimes a CEO needs to make a decision for, you know, and including, are there categories of people that I'm not going to bank? And should the CEO's hands be tied in making that decision? Let me turn it over to you for your thoughts.
Thank you. And thanks, Todd, for his comments. The answer to me is the CEO needs to be able to make that decision. We already have way, way too many regulations. I think forcing organizations to take on customers they don't want, it wouldn't be healthy for the customer or the organization. Now, I also think in a free market, the vast majority of people can get banking services. The reason that people don't get banking services, the regulatory cost is so high. The programs are actually designed to help low-income people probably hurt low-income people because the regulatory cost is so high. I want to go back and give some content text for what's happening now, because I joined BB&T in 1971. So I've seen this, I guess, story unfold. And it's not new. It's different each time, but it's not new. Unfortunately, the banking industry has been politicized pretty consistently for a long period of time. And the worst thing about the politicization is it goes in waves. One day it's against the law to do X. The next day you ought to do X. You have to do X. And what that creates is a massive misallocation of capital. You know, banks were basically designed to allow modest income, low income savers, particularly typically older people, to have a safe way to invest their money. And at the same time, to allow the community to have capital to do things that took more than the small savings of individuals. And banks functioned that way even when I joined the industry in the early 70s. But beginning in that period of time, well, there was a political background, the political process got worse and worse. One of the beginnings of that was when the Federal Reserve, trying to fix the mess it had made, drove interest rates so high that a lot of banks and tremendous number of savings and loans failed. The savings and loans were designed to finance houses with fixed rate mortgages. And when their cost of funds went to 20% and they were getting 7% on their mortgages, it was a tough business to be in. And out of desperation, the savings and loans were forced by their regulators in many cases to get into lending business they had no expertise in, financing apartment complexes, shopping centers, all over the country. Local savings and loan in some small town in, you know, Eastern Virginia was financing a large apartment complex in Arizona, and tons of savings and loans failed. And the banking industry ended up consolidating those companies. But I guarantee you, a huge percentage of those institutions would have never gone into those lending businesses without lots of regulatory pressure. It was kind of the thing to do, regulatory pressure. And of course, when the industry failed, the whole real estate market collapsed, and it took the economy in general with it. During the Clinton administration, we had another interesting experience. Clinton got elected with a lot of support from the African-American community. And one of his themes was he was going to pay back by showing there was a massive amount of racial discrimination in the banking industry. Well, the fact was, probably going back to the 1950s, there had been racial discrimination. By the time Clinton got elected, banks needed all the good loans they could find, and there was probably no racial discrimination. But they created these crazy arbitrary models and proved, quote, that banks were racially discriminating. A lot of banks gave in because it was cheaper just to pay a fine and drive home. At BB&T, we hadn't racially discriminated. We actually operated in markets that in many cases had 40 and 50% African-American communities. And that was a huge part of our base. So we fought the regulators. Fortunately for us, 2 years after Clinton was in, there was a pushback. Most people aren't old enough to remember that. And Republicans took over Congress. And the day after the Republicans took over Congress, all the regulators went home. It was the end of the push for about racial discrimination, which just shows how politicized the process is. And that is clearly not rule of law for the Federalists. And that is one of the biggest problems. We've got a bunch of regulations, but they're so malleable with the current environment, it makes it very difficult to operate. Bush got very excited over terrorism, of course, after 9/11. And we had a number of laws on the books, really designed to deal with drug dealers initially, that were redesigned to focus on terrorism, which meant it was a huge witch hunt for terrorists. And basically, they never found any. I know when I talked to the various regulatory agencies, they couldn't come up. Now, maybe something's happened since I retired. They couldn't come up with a single example of a terrorist that had been caught by these regulations. And yet the regulatory cost to banks was huge and remains huge today. And the violation of individual rights remains very significant. Affordable housing, you know, that was a, both a Republican and Democratic theme. And of course, led to the last economic correction, where banks were not only encouraged, they were forced to have large portfolios of what were called affordable housing that was really subprime lending. There were loans that banks shouldn't have made, wouldn't have made if it hadn't been regulatorily required. And of course, what it did spur some secondary consequences. This is what people tend to ignore. You had tons of people that went out and bought 4, 5, and 6 houses and were flipping them, right? So really, yeah, they couldn't afford 4, 5, 6 houses. But once the party stopped, of course, they all went bankrupt. And it caused a massive economic correction. Again, banks wouldn't have done that except under terrific regulatory pressure and incentives. Obama basically views banks as the bad guys, and he tightened regulations across the whole spectrum, which made it very difficult for banks to do traditional lending. Now, I had been at BB&T a long period of time. We were a conservative lender, and we did really well relatively in bad times because other banks quit lending, and we accelerated our lending activity because there were a lot of good customers that other banks that were in trouble couldn't accommodate, but we couldn't do it this time because the regulators came in and tightened the lending standards on healthy banks. And in that process really caused the duration of the recession to be much longer and work. We really didn't frankly truly recover until Trump got elected. And that was totally unnecessary. We could have recovered. We could have, if we had allowed the market to correct, allowed banks and investment banks to clean up the bad loans they'd made, maybe some banks would have failed. Maybe some large banks would have failed, and that would have been good. That would have been justice. But within 6 months, 9 months, we'd have had an economic recovery, and we'd have a much higher standard of living today than we have. It was an unnecessary, gross regulatory overreaction. And having been around a long time, I could personally see that. And BB&T, which had had, we didn't have a single quarterly loss during the recession. And yet the regulators radically tightened the lending standards and forced us basically to put out of business a lot of people that didn't need to go out of business. I mean, people that had good businesses that had been in business a long time. It was a human tragedy. It was a completely irrational overreaction by the Obama administration. And it was a radical change in standards. They just We didn't have rule of law. We just had new standards. Of course, Todd talked about the new focus, which is on climate change primarily. That's really the big theme of the Biden administration. And so banks are really being encouraged to make a lot of regulatory issues and force their customer base to change their business models in many cases in the name of climate change. That will do tremendous damage to our economy, because a lot of businesses that really aren't doing any damage to the economy, to the climate, will be forced to spend a lot of money, time, effort, and energy in non-productive ways. By the way, this isn't new. This climate change thing is not new. Those have been around long enough. In the 70s, we had a real climate crisis too, but in that case, instead of burning up, we were going to freeze to death. People forget that. We were all going to freeze to death. And because we had several years of very abnormally low temperatures. And global cooling was a big, big concern. Things started to warm up a little bit. Now it's global warming. The whole focus, by the way, on windmills is not new. There was huge incentives for banks to finance windmills back during the right after the Arabian oil embargoes, and banks were basically forced to get into the alternative energy business. I know we financed some windmills. They all went broke eventually. Fortunately, we didn't do enough to do a lot of damage to our bank. But windmills, that's a technology from the 1400s. Yeah, they're improved. They slaughter birds. They do a tremendous amount of environmental damage. And yet that's the theme of the progressive, let's build some more windmills. If you really were worried about climate change, you'd probably objectively focus on nuclear energy. There's been massive advances in technology and related to nuclear energy. You probably saw where Bill Gates is pursuing building a nuclear power plant. The environmental damage is minimum. I'm not sure that climate, the threat of global warming has been proven enough that we want to invest a huge amount of money to prevent further global warming without more evidence and without seeing how the market will develop technologies. If this is really a problem, I think we'll see huge improvements in energy use technology. You know, if you look at natural gas and what's been done with how we find oil, those are massive improvements and were not sponsored at all. They were fought by governments in many cases. And yet they've not only brought down the cost of energy, they brought down the energy impact. Natural gas is far less impactful on the environment than coal is. And that was developed by markets. So my whole career is one of watching regulatory overreach driven by politics. And every case that I can think of, and this is going back, since the early 1970s, government policy forced the market in the wrong direction. Not that markets are perfect, not that market participants don't make mistakes, but markets are driven by longer-term rational analysis versus political equations. And they're also self-correcting in the sense that if you do something that's dumb, the market punishes you. I'm a little concerned with the idea of expanding the government's role. I'm one that would say less contracted. That may happen naturally, by the way, as being an old-timey banker, I hate to see this, as more and more financial services leave the traditional banking industry. I think there's some interesting costs to that. I think it'd be better to have rational, long-term regulation of the industry. I do think it serves an important social service. But if it gets too politicized, if the difference between the free market and the regulation, if it closes much more, I guess I would have to disagree with Todd on this. I think there's a risk that the traditional banking industry will continue to fade as a percentage of financing in the U.S. And in some ways, maybe that'll be good, because I'm sure there are innovations in internet and the other ways. In other ways, I think it will be bad because I think banks, traditional banks, have served a very important role in financing traditional businesses in communities. And I think when that role gets distorted by regulations or the what I call the range of the moment, let's build some more windmills kind of mentality, lots of economic damage happens. Lots of economic damage happens. And I'm for fighting the expansion of regulation on every front we can. No one will lose a lot of battles in the short term, but hoping the political pendulum will swing back. And I'm not a politician, but I'll predict it will. It always has. You know, Clinton got elected and 2 years later, the winds blew exactly the opposite direction. So when you go too far, and I'm not a political analyst, my gut is that Biden administration has gone way beyond what Biden got elected to do. You know, he was elected as kind of a moderate liberal, and a lot of these positions he's taken on a lot of issues are very progressive issues. And so I'd be careful about running the bank overreacting, because 2 years from now, as happened with Bill Clinton, what you thought on racial disparity may not be true anymore. The law may swing back. In fact, I certainly think there's better than 50-50 chance the law will start out with a massive increase in regulations and related to things like global warming. And 2 years from now, I think we're going to get a political swing back, because I think the damage to the economy will be significant. And then you will have wasted a lot of time, effort, and energy and money on something that won't happen, or at least will be moderated. One man's view.
John, that was an impressive argument. And I wanted to pick up on a thread that your position, I believe, was that no, we shouldn't force banks to bank someone that they don't want to bank. And you talked a lot about how banks are pressured by political authorities and the regulators to do things, right? That's the banking industry is really tacked pretty sharply based on political pressure. So I guess let's feed this back over to Todd, because is there some kind of consumer remedy or right, constitutional or otherwise, if someone can't get a bank account or they're kicked out of a bank due to the regulatory pressure on that bank? Like, might there be a due process, First Amendment, equal protection claim on behalf of the consumer? Because this bad result to them could be traced right back to the government itself. And I want to credit a question that came in for this question. One of our viewers fed this question into us.
Yeah, I saw that, and it's a great question. And John, thank you for your thoughts. And let me emphasize, I'm also very troubled by the idea of the potential of the government expanding rather than contracting here. So I have no misconceptions about this. I have no misconceptions about trying to come up with ways of regulating the internet, in the like. You know, sort of the way I think about this is there's sort of two inquiries that we would think about with respect to this, which is first, is there a problem? And then second, is there a solution that would make things better rather than making them worse? My view is, and I know a lot of people disagree with me, is my view is that this is a problem. My view is that internet censorship is a problem in many different sorts of ways. And that this is a problem for banking, right? The way that it is, as John has said, it's always been politicized, but it's especially politicized now, and it's politicized in a predictable ideological direction now. I think that's a real problem, and I think a lot of people would. And it may turn out to be self-correcting for the reasons John said, or maybe the markets do work here over the long run. Maybe the regulatory process does work here. And so maybe it's a problem, but maybe it's just a transient problem. Maybe it's just a small problem and not a big problem. That's a reasonable response. But the second question is, if it is a problem, we do think it's a big problem, is there a viable solution? And I am by no means persuaded that there is a solution that would make things better rather than worse, right? I'm certainly not persuaded that the solutions that are being proposed to deal with ideologically biased internet censorship would make things better rather than worse. I have not come up with a solution that I am comfortable making things better than worse. Is something like the fair access rule that Controller Brooks proposed? It might be. Why do I think it might be? Partly because it does have this very similar sort of historical, sort of logical pedigree to the argument that Richard Epstein was making with respect to, you know, internet service providers and sort of, you know, those sorts of arguments that he made in the Wall Street Journal about having, you know, that sort of quasi-monopolies or sort of government-protected industries have to not discriminate against people on illegitimate terms, right? I may be wrong about that. I'm still trying to figure it out. But it could very well be, as I think John well suggests, that the costs are greater than the benefits of going down that road, partly because the problem, it may not be as bad as I think, and maybe the costs are much worse than I think, which I am certainly second to no one in being concerned about the cynicism of government regulators in terms of how they're going to exercise any powers that we give to them, as we have all learned to our chagrin from the experience under the Chevron doctrine, where, you know, regulators basically push not only to the extreme, but beyond. They basically filled the vacuum of every power we give them. So that's sort of the big question. So is one of the possible remedies, to get to your question, Daniel, and the other person's question, is one of the possible remedies a private right of action or some sort of thing? And it does really come up against exactly this same question as it plays out today, which is traditionally, in order to be able to state a First Amendment claim, an equal protection claim under the Constitution, you have to have state action, is the question asked. And so my understanding, I haven't looked at the Operation Choke Point complaint for a while, and I can't remember where that case ended up. I think it was settled. But I think in that case, you had enough government oversight that they discovered through the discovery process and the litigation that they were able to pin it back on the government. What about a situation now where you basically have private, so, you know, sort of titularly private businesses blackballing people, titularly private businesses under pressure from so-called stakeholders or investors like BlackRock, who are basically forcing them to pick and choose who they're going to be allowed to bank with? Now those constitutional protections don't obviously apply. And it's not obvious that statutory protections would apply, especially if the statutes and regulators have come down on the other side of the issue. And so now it's hard to see exactly what your legal remedy may be in that realm for an individual, at least as far as I can tell. I'm not a litigator, though. I'm sort of more of a regulatory type guy, but it's not quite clear. As you know, Parler tried to come up with an antitrust claim. I mean, it is interesting that if you look at the fair access rule, it is targeted very much at banks, large banks and banks, whether they believe they have market power. So they have tried to tie it to traditional antitrust law doctrines. And the logic of that would have been to basically give people a private right of action under the rule, right? The rule never got published in the, I should have said this, the rule never got published in the Federal Register. And so it never became effective. And immediately the Biden administration, with the encouragement of the big banks, I will add, all the large banks opposed that rule, pulled that rule back. And so it didn't become official. And so right now, my sense is that people are kind of, they don't really have any sort of private right of action.
So for the person who happens to be unfashionable, politically disfavored, they can be put in a very difficult position if they really don't have a legal right of action. Where do they go? How do they survive? I guess I'll put this back on John. I mean, early on, you alluded to in the 50s, there was this practice of redlining where banks would draw a red line around certain neighborhoods and allegedly say they're not going to lend in there. And those were the minority neighborhoods. isn't this sort of activity where you're withholding crucial deposit services from people, could that not also have a disparate impact on, you know, peoples who are protected by virtue of religion or their ethnicity or some other protected class? I mean, isn't there that risk of banks avoiding one quagmire and stepping right into another?
Well, there definitely is. And now redlining, going back to the 50s, was actually done mostly by insurance companies, not by banks. And what happened is the banks couldn't make loans because they couldn't get fiscal property insurance in those redlined areas. So, you know, you can finance a building, but you can't get property and you can't get fire insurance. You can't make a loan there. And that's actually what caused banks not to make loans in that area. And not really because of any racial discrimination. I'm not saying that some black people might not have bad souls. I don't know how to judge that. But it really was because they couldn't get property insurance. They couldn't get fire insurance. I think that that if you look at what banks would rationally do in a free market, they're not going to discriminate for reasons that don't make economic sense because of the competitive pressure will keep them from doing that. So if you get that kind of crazy discrimination, the irony is the government will be causing it. It will be caused. I mean, it's like the progressives wanting internet companies to discriminate against conservatives, which is clearly going on today and clearly happening today. And you could get the same kind of thing, like banks being forced not to make loans to gun dealers that the bank might feel very safe making a loan to, but it won't be because banks want to do it, not because there's too much economic pressure and too much competition. They would do it because they were afraid of their regulators. And there's no question about it. Now, you know, I was, I guess, naive when I was at BB&T. We just kept driving home. And we had a lot of regulatory smoke, but we didn't have a lot of regulatory fire. But unfortunately, when I retired, and I don't know why, they got re-energized and the regulatory pressure went up dramatically at BB&T. And I think it did a lot of damage both to the organization, but mostly did a lot of damage to our customer base. So I don't see in a fairly, even a regulated market, but where people aren't forced to drive out customers that would otherwise be good customers, that they'll do it. I don't think you can because it's too competitive. And particularly financial services now, not because banks are so, banks are plenty competitive, but I mean, just think of all the ways you get financial services today. And I think this is one of the ironies. If the regulators force banks out of these niches, somebody will figure out how to serve the niches. And over time, the banks will become less and less of a force in the financial environment. And that, I don't actually think that will be good for the economy because I think banks are pretty rational, have a pretty rational history as an industry, not individual banks, of allocating credit in a way that creates economic well-being. So the irony is the regulatory pressure to force banks out of this niche or that niche will make banks less competitive. I think people will find ways to get financing in other ways. And the end of it will be more and more resources flowing out of the banking industry, which is really what's happening today. And from the economic perspective, will be a less efficient use of capital.
That's a great, I mean, I love that. I mean, that's a fascinating line of thought, John, that I've never really thought about before, and is very important. And here's a question I have as I think about that, right? Which is, so like you, what I was suggesting is sort of a completely different starting point, right? Which is I was sort of, you know, sort of this world of the second best versus where we are now. And like you, I'm always jittery about the idea of expanding regulation, but the example that you're giving sort of makes kind of helps me kind of crystallize my thinking, which is kind of take it and flip it on its head and think about employment law, right? And so a lot of free market people are very wedded to the idea of preserving employment at will, right? Freedom of contract and the like. But the reality is that in today's labor markets, employment at will really only applies to white males under the age of 40, right? 75, 80% of the workforce is not employment at will. And so employment at will basically means you have the right to fire any white male under the age of 40 for any reason, including their politics, and everybody else is protected, right? And so it kind of, when you start thinking about it that way, right, in a world in which the default rule really is employment at will, we want to preserve that, right? In a world in which the default rule is you can discriminate against white males and nobody else, it's not clear that you necessarily want to draw the line in the same place. And your example about sort of escaping the net that the regulatory system kind of brought to mind the analogy there, which is the answer to that has been, gig economy, right? Uber and Lyft, Uber Eats, all this sort of stuff that basically to escape the archaic sort of binary, right? We've got this binary New Deal type system that's very similar there, right? You've got employees and you've got contractors. And so a lot of people are like, I want to be a contractor because I don't want all the hassle of being an employer, and employee and everything goes along with it. So what's been the response of the regulators? We got to go out and get all the, under the pressure from the unions and everybody else, we got to go get all those independent contractors and protect them as employees, whether they want to be protected or not, right? And so it seems like, my concern would be, and I agree with you, that what we're seeing are a lot of nifty, nimble ways in which new startups, such as, I'm guessing Daniel, I would be interested in hearing what Daniel's doing in this area, but the fintech companies, that sort of thing, are trying to escape the web, to escape the net. And what's going on is now everybody wants to chase after them, right? Well, you're a fintech company, but you got to comply with CRA regulation. You got to comply with, these incredibly expensive and counterproductive money laundering provisions, right? To anti-terrorist financing type stuff. And so it seems like every time we try to escape the web, the regulators just gobble up more and more and kind of keep devouring things. And so that's kind of, that's the dynamic that I fear that you're describing, which is for perfectly rational reasons, people want to get out of this irrational system. And then they keep, like the Godfather, every time I think I'm out, they pull me back in type thing.
But, and I definitely agree that's what the regulators try to do. I have to say, I think they're chasing a moving target in today's world. I think technology is moving so fast that they're going to lose. Now, that doesn't mean that they might gobble up Uber, but I think in general, the regulatory ability to control what's going on is getting less, not because they wouldn't like for it to be more, and not because they aren't chasing other things, but I think technology is advancing so fast and moving so quick. Okay, they get Uber, then there's a new super Uber that has some other bell and whistle. I think the good news is not that we haven't got a big fight to have, and I think that's one of the roles, by the way, of the federal society is right to fight the expansion of regulation. I think it's a very, very important role. But I don't think the regulators can win this game. And part of that's technology and part of it's globalization. Mm-hmm. I just think the baby's moving on, and I think that's good. I think it's good. But that doesn't mean that we don't want to fight on every front and every time the regulators win, we reduce the standard of living. And usually the people, by the way, that get hurt are poor people, and then they talk about the disparity in income for the regulations that they did that hurt the poor people. But Uber drivers, generically speaking, aren't high income people. And they're going to make less income under the regulatory environment they would if they didn't get regulated. But of course, now the irony too is that in a lot of cases, now Uber's got trouble in California, but they're winning in Texas. So Is that going to drive a higher standard of living taxes? I say yes. I say it's one of the nice things of having, the model we have in the United States. And that's one reason that we want to fight centralized control versus state laws. I'd much rather a state make a bad law because there are going to be consequences. Resources are going to and they're shifting pretty fast. They're moving out of the Northeast to the Southeast. They're moving out of California and they're moving rapidly. In fact, I don't think we've ever had any kind of a movement like we've had in terms of wealth and people out of these highly regulated environments. And I think if anything, it's going to accelerate. So I think we want to fight as many things. In fact, that's one of the progressives' motivations. They want to stop the South and areas that haven't followed these crazy regulations, because the consequences are the people that are highly regulated are losing. And they're losing in big numbers, in big time, in the quality of life and the standard of living, including particularly low-income people. And so I think we need to fight the regulatory environment at the national level as strongly as we can. And I think that the forces of technology and markets are more powerful, interestingly enough, despite the regulatory environment, than they've been probably in human, maybe not to the 1920s, but probably in human history. And
you made a great point.
Gives me hope.
Oh, sorry. I never heard the point about that you had about the housing market and the impact of insurance, which is very interesting. And you know, I know one other component of that emphasizes a point you made, John, is it turns out that we have known for decades in the economic literature, discrimination can only persist in markets without competition. And we've Absolutely. Learned that again and again. Why were we able to have racially discriminatory and redlining for so long? Because the federal government had a policy that made banks discriminate because they wouldn't discriminate on their own. It's as simple as that. It was the FHFA and all those guys who basically told banks, you're not allowed to lend in integrating communities because it'll be too risky, right? I guess that was their version of reputation risk, right? Without that, it wouldn't have been a problem. We see it today, which is that the empirical evidence with respect to fintech is quite clear, which is that when fintech enters markets, I'm not going to say it's discrimination, but the racial disparities in prices are smaller. They shrink when fintech enters markets and puts competitive pressure on incumbents. And what do they think the solution now is? More barriers to entry, more regulations on fintech, more regulation that interferes with things like, you know, credit cards competing against across state lines and the like, which is in an era nowadays where this is what we are concerned about, and as well we should be. Every single way of thinking about this is completely backwards from what all of history and economic literature tells us, which is competition entry is the best way to address these problems, not more government, not more monopolies. I mean, for Pete's sake, seriously, their solution is that the post office should give people bank accounts. That's their solution. That, you know, is basically it, and the rest of us, you know, everybody else gets FedEx banking, but you're poor. So you got to go to the post office and get there by 5, right? I mean, it's like, it's ridiculous. And it doesn't even pass the straight face test, in my view.
Funny story, as we're cruising towards the close here. In my group that's organizing a new bank, we wanted to be a cool fintech and have matching vests, you know, with our logo. Oh. I put in an order to Patagonia, you know, to get a embroidered vest with the name of the bank on it. And I was surprised to be turned down by Patagonia because some intense virtue signaling in which they said, we don't sell clothes to banks and financial institutions because they're icky. It was like a reverse debanked. And so, you know, I went out and bought a cool vest, right? And saved money and I got a better product over Patagonia. I tend to come down on this. I think where we're all coming out is the power of free enterprise. For me, I protect JP Morgan's sacred right to signal virtue and turn away clients that I'm only too happy to have, right? More power to JP Morgan. Someone will step in and someone's going to make a lot of money banking the unwanted stepchildren of the financial industry.
Could you say a little bit more, Daniel, I had not heard about what you're doing. I know you're starting a new commercial bank that's designed to be a response to this problem. Could you say a little bit more about where you're at in that process? And I'm asking from a personal perspective, but I'm also asking on behalf of many other members of the Federalist Society who are disgusted by what's going on in the world and would love quite frankly, to support a bank that supports freedom of speech and freedom of association. And so I know I'm not the only one here who would be interested in hearing. So give us your advertising pitch to the Federalist Society.
Well, I'm only too happy to. I'll give you the one minute spiel, but the idea is, you know, we took a look at that Operation Choke Point list of companies that were debanked, and we thought that's a pretty good client set. Within that are sectors that are very profitable and good businesses. And so that's our specialized area. So, you know, we went to the regulators and said, we're going to specialize in high risk businesses because we think they're awesome. and the basic value proposition of our bank is, you know, we have sort of best in class risk management, but we're loyal to our customers. It really doesn't matter whether you're fashionable this week and unfashionable the next. If you're a law-abiding citizen, you're welcome here. And that's the principle of the bank.
And you are open for business now?
We're working on that.
Working on that.
It's a high bar to clear, really, to open any new bank, especially one like ours. But to the regulator's credit, right? They've asked a lot of hard questions, but it's all been professional, and we believe we're on track.
And I think that's the new frontier, to emphasize John's point, right? Which is, we saw some great movements, I think, over the past several years, not just in the fintech area, but basically, I can't remember the name of them, but like the Harley Davidson Bank and the the ones I'm talking about, sort of the commercial banking type things. I think, you know, I hope someday Walmart reapplies for banking charter, right? There's all kind of ways in which, to John's point, financial services can be delivered these days. And getting over those regulatory hurdles, number one, and getting over the entrenched opposition of the incumbents, right? Walmart wanted a banking charter over 10 years ago, and they basically got squashed by the community banks more than anybody else, right? And so this market, this world in which the incumbents have so much control over entry, I think is hopefully something that will change eventually. Saw some reform in that over the past few years, and I hope that continues and that they allow these new entities to flourish such as yours, because that really is the obvious long-term solution, I think.
Thank you. Sure. We got some good questions in, but I don't want to extend the hour longer than what the Federalist Society has promised. So I'll leave it up to them, up to the Federalist Society to decide if they want to extend it just a little bit.
You can go another couple minutes, Daniel, but we do expect people will step out. We're going to offer, it's 1 hour of CLE, so we're not going to go another half hour.
In our practice group member, Dina Roachkind, asked a good question about ESGs generally, right? And this is a good example, you know, about sort of climate diversity, all this political disclosures, all this sort of stuff. And this is the kind of nether region of financial regulation, right? Which is, disclosures aren't just disclosures in the banking world, right? They pick and choose what you're going to disclose because they want to do something with that, is basically the case. And so it's a way of basically, putting the screws to private companies. Well, just saying, all we're doing is just asking for information, kind of thing, right? And so I think, you know, and that's where I start getting heartburn on a lot of these things. So,
yeah, we could probably talk a lot about ESGs, to have a fund or guide your investments under criterion that aren't profit driven, right? Sort of the B corporation mentality or motif. In my observation, right, I haven't been personally involved in any of that, sort of measuring yourself, like how do you make that accountable is very, very subjective and problematic. whereas profits, you either have it or you don't. Right. And it's much easier to manage towards a profit goal than I think some of these subject ESG goals.
Well, this is something I've been trying to get at in my own research, which is the justification that's given is, well, we have to do this because all these millennials and Gen Z people make us do it, right? And so it's protected by the business judgment rule. It's just good business. Well, number one, that's not obvious in the empirical data, right? That might be true, but there's not a lot of obvious evidence that that's true. And there's also theoretical reasons to raise eyebrows a little bit at the argument that we're doing this because it's a good business practice, which is CEOs have also made that argument about participation in political activity. And there is a great bulk of empirical literature that shows that being engaged in political activity does not help a company's bottom line. And what people have looked at that, political scientists, economists have concluded, is that what that really is just what we call agency cost, which is the CEO likes palling around with politicians, and he basically uses he or she uses the money and the prestige of the company so that they get to go, you know, they get invited to the French Laundry to have lunch with the governor, right? But it isn't actually helping the company. And I think that there's a real need for empirical evidence here and for people to start digging into this question, which is, they just sort of assert these sort of, you know, crude sort of stereotypes about millennials and Gen Zs and what's needed and that sort of thing. But I think there's some really important empirical work that could be done to determine whether or not that's actually true or not, or whether or not that's just them making up an excuse for them to kind of make sure they get a good seat at Davos next year because they've said and done the right things and boycotted the right people in industries.
Yeah, you know, I know in the banking industry from experience, most of the politically connected CEOs have run bad banks at the end of the day. not 100%, but a lot of them. And the second thing, look at a lot of these environmental funds. And if you look at their investments, they either have one or two things. They don't have very good returns, or they have a lot of things in it that you got to be really irrationalizing to say this is a good environment. It might be a good investment, but the reason the fund's doing okay is they didn't really buy the environmental arguments that they presented in their prospectus because they didn't. If you look at what they bought, it's not that different than somebody that hadn't had any environmental argument. So, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah.
Good deal. Well, thanks again to both of our panelists. It was a real pleasure to see you both in action and have a really lively conversation. Appreciate everybody for tuning in and the Federalist Society for hosting this fabulous event.
Well, thank you, Daniel. Thank you, the Federalist Society. John, it's always a treat to hear your experiences and thoughts on this. And Daniel, I know I'm not speaking just for myself, but I'm sure a lot of people are on this call. Good luck on your new bank and let us know when you start taking consumer deposits.
Yeah. Thank you, Daniel. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks to all of you for listening.
All right.
Thanks.
Good one.